Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Last week on Smart Talk, we spoke with Republican State Senator David Argo of Schuylkill County about his plan to eliminate school property taxes and replace the revenue for schools with increases in the income tax and sales tax, along with an expansion of items that are subject to the sales tax. It's well known that property taxes are among the most disliked tax in Pennsylvania.
It's unfair. It's archaic. Certainly there has to be a better way to fund public schools than how many acres do you live on, what kind of house, how big, what kind of roof, did you fix the paint on your front door? I mean, that's nuts.
However, there are reasons the unpopular property tax hasn't been eliminated or reformed in the 40 years many have tried. School districts, for one, don't support Argo's plan. Joining us today to talk about that is John Callahan, his chief advocacy officer with the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. Mr. Callahan, welcome back to the program.
It's always a pleasure to be on.
If you have a question or comment, and we know you do, we had a lot of calls last week about property taxes, and Mr. Callahan's going to be on with us for probably a half hour or so, so get your calls in soon. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. John, PSBA doesn't support Senate Bill 76, which is Senator Argo's bill. It's not just Senator Argo, but he is among the leading proponents of the bill that would completely eliminate property taxes. Why not?
Well, I mean, first, I think we have to talk about school boards and themselves. I mean, they've got the primary responsibility here on property taxes and to make that vote. And it's one of the hardest votes as a school board member you have to make when you're talking about budgets, when you're talking about what you need to do for the school district. And I think all those people that are elected are there for one reason, that kind of for the benefit of their schools, to make sure that kids are being educated. And really, I mean, when we're talking about that even further, to make sure Pennsylvania has a good economy and the future of our economy in Pennsylvania. So, I mean, that's what public education is there for. But, you know, here we are with the property tax. And primarily, that's one of the main ways that we're funded. So how, you know, what do we do with it when it's the most, as you say, most hated tax in Pennsylvania? I would very much, and I think our members would love to get away from the property tax. It just comes down to a proposal that works, actually, that needs to work financially and kind of recognize some of the stresses that are out there within school district budgets and really pay for them. And we looked at it and we say, well, we're really concerned about making sure the numbers work. And I think the other individuals on the other side of this debate think that the numbers work, but we've got to really kind of come together and say, let's make sure that if we are going to switch, and I think a lot of school board members would like that kind of switch, that in the end, we are paying for public education. We're paying for the future of our economy. We're paying for our students and having, you know, a good place to live. Because at the end of the day, when you buy a house or you try to sell your house, what's the first thing people ask for? Well, how's the school district? Because people care about these things, and so do we.
Last year, Pennsylvania school districts brought in about $14.4 billion with property taxes. As you say, the numbers, you want to make sure the numbers work. That $14.4 billion under this Senate Bill 76, Senator Argo last week on our program said the numbers do work. They've done research into it. Why don't you think they work?
Well, let's kind of go after a few, I guess, myth-busting facts here, I guess you could say. One thing is you have to have a base of where education funding comes from in the state. And so we're looking at the local funding is probably about 63% of the total pot is local funding. And only 36 right now comes from the state. So you're trying to address that 63% that's out there. With the costs that are on school districts, and this is the thing within the bill, one of the biggest, I think, challenges is it says, well, every year, we're first off going to replace what you make in property tax right now. Whatever you know, if you make $1 in property tax and that pays for your school district, we're going to replace that. So $1. But the problem is, from there, they say, we're going to give you an increase every year, a COLA, a cost of living adjustment. And we're going to calculate that between 2 and 5%, whatever that math is every year. But the underlying issue is that costs within school districts, mandated cost, don't follow that COLA. And so that's where the numbers really get screwed off. We're talking about special education increases. Let me kind of give you some numbers. In 2007, the difference between what the state funded and feds and what our cost was for special ed is about $1.3 billion. And you know who made that up.
That's the difference.
That was the difference. The people that made that up were property tax owners. Now, that's back in 2007. Now, we look at 2015, which is like the last year we have good numbers for. It's grown to a $3 billion difference between what the state and feds give to school districts and what school districts have to spend in special education costs. And that was made up by property tax, local decisions at the end of the day. Now, we're also looking at property tax. One of my favorite issues here is pensions, and we bring that up. And we say, well, how much do pensions cost? In 2015, we were looking at $549 million and $63 million in charter increase costs. These are things that you can't control. That is since 2010, between 2010 and 2015, that's a 337% increase just in that line item, just in pensions. So that goes far beyond what a COLA would pay for, and that's something we don't control. That's something that the state controls, that we're mandated to pay. So with just looking at pensions, the COLA kind of increase doesn't even come close to recognizing that problem, doesn't recognize the special education cost problem, which is a mandate. You have to pay for that. And charter schools as well, you know, that's another one that as that happens, there was a 61% increase between 2010 and 2015. That's another cost that shifts how things are being paid and something you don't really control that cost.
But that is that money that you're talking about included in that $14.4 billion? And then the second part of that question is, for those who support Senate Bill 76 eliminating property taxes, is that taken, those increases you just described, taken into account?
Those increases, this sounds funny, would not be taken into account because we're talking about it. It gives you that dollar-to-dollar exchange and then says you're going to have this COLA, but it doesn't calculate in all the extraneous huge costs that are mandated in there. It presumes that there's going to be just a general cost of living when, I mean, to be honest, public schools don't have a general cost of living. They have mandated costs that are uncontrolled. Now, how do school districts deal with that right now? And I want to kind of bust another myth here. A lot of people say to me, well, you haven't controlled cost. And I'm going to look at the year 2010 to 2015 because we actually have hard numbers on that. The salaries between those years went down by 3%. You know, so schools actually cut salaries. And all other expenses within that time period went up by 6%. So we can control cost, but the problem is the stuff that we can control doesn't follow in that 5% increase. It doesn't really follow neatly in a cost of living. So that's really where the numbers, I think, come to loggerheads. And if we could... And one person on your call in last time said, you got to address the spending issue. Well, it's not that we're overspending. I think a lot of school districts are being diligent about their spending. It's just that their mandated costs that they can't control are well beyond what other people would expect.
We actually have a caller who has a comment along those lines. Steve is in Halifax. Steve, you're on. Whoops, I think you must have answered his question, but he was saying that he thinks that the school districts are spending too much. Let's look at so stable income is you know, you talked about the money and whether Senate Bill 76 actually makes up for the revenue that is brought in by the property tax. But something else that PSBA has said, school districts have said, is that the property tax provides a stable income. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, those are just kind of tax policy wonk things, I admit, sometimes. When you're talking about property tax, you can predictably assume that, you know, it's going to increase by this much or this is what it's going to be bringing in next year. And when you're talking about school budgets, it sure does help you when you know exactly how much you're going to get in revenue for the year so that you can plan out your curriculum, you can plan out your next year's budget. You know, one of the complaints is, of course, sales tax goes up and down, personal income tax goes up and down, depending on the economy. And I think you'd have to build in, and I think the proponents of this bill have built in a little bit of a rainy day. I think you have to build in
savings,
quite a bit more to kind of have the flux in there to deal with, you know, another recession or something of that sort. So that's something that I think it sounds funny. I think they've got it partly right, but not all the way right for how far those numbers would go up and down. And that's hard to predict. We want, I think this is one of the things where we both have the same goals. We want predictable funding. We want to fund the public education system the best and make it the most successful thing. We want to make it the most competitive thing in the nation. We want to compete among all the states. Well, it's going to take dollars to do that, and it's going to take something very stable and thoughtful about how you fund that.
You mentioned that school districts receive 37% of their funding from the state. That's actually up a little bit in the recent the last decade or so. It was down to about 35, maybe even below 35%. I remember during the Rendell administration, Governor Rendell saying that we want to get back up to the point where the state was funding 50%. This bill, the money would come from the state. I mean, if it was a sales and income tax, it would come from the state to school districts. Your criticism, the criticism of those who, one of the criticisms that oppose this bill, is that school districts would lose local control. But you just said that you want a predictable source of income. Wouldn't money from the state then be a predictable source of income?
You know, and this is where I think we have a lot in common between the proponents of saying we don't mind doing the switch. We just need to make sure that it is predictable. And we kind of talked a little bit about that a few seconds ago. But when you're talking about the details here of how that switch is going to happen, where's the control of things? So when you make that switch, the state assumes all those costs. I'm guessing, the best guess we got. The state is going to assume the pension costs. They're going to assume the charter costs. They're going to assume the special education costs, the health care increase costs. I didn't even talk about that. That's going to be the state's responsibility now. And when that comes to play and there's an increase in those things that, like I've been talking about, who's going to have to pay for that? The legislature would have to vote to increase some sort of money to pay for that stuff. And I think the plan really doesn't kind of take into account those costs, and therefore, and the political nature of trying to increase those dollars for those line items. And so now you've got a very unstable system, a very politically unstable system.
The majority of school districts in this state over the last few years have raised property taxes. Now, I know one of the reasons is because of those pensions that you mentioned. But when the majority of school districts are raising taxes, and it is happening year after year, I mean, their districts are having to get exemptions from Act 1, which was supposed to put a limit on how much they could raise taxes. That does not sound like a stable source of income if you have to constantly go back to taxpayers and say, we need more money.
Yeah, I mean, I met my members, school board members hate doing that. I mean, it is what you're forced into. And I think when you're in a school board position, you start looking at that budget. You start realizing this is how much it costs to educate a kid. What do we have to do? And you mentioned Act 1. And Act 1 kind of does put that cap on how much you can increase. And here's a good example. If Act 1, if I collect, was able to increase all the property tax in Pennsylvania to the Act 1 index in 2015, I get $262 million out of that. But then, just talking about pension increase, that was a $549 million problem that year, increase. So you are inevitably, that difference, you're going to have to find some way to pay for that. And you can cut your programs to a certain level. You can raise money, and this is what school districts are doing. They're cutting, they're raising money from other sources. They're trying all kinds of stuff. I mean, you've seen sponsorships happening in gyms and in cafeterias. All kinds of nifty ideas are happening. But there's a point where you say, well, now I'm forced to make a property tax increase. And I believe, and I've seen, that that is significantly what's happening on the local level. Is the locals are really, I mean, the little secret around here is when the state doesn't give you all the money that you need, and when there's more bills from the state than you expect, then it falls to the local property tax owners. I wish it wasn't so.
But during the Wolf administration, this was one of Governor Wolf's priorities, was to provide more money in education, and it's up to about $1 billion more than when the governor took office. That sounds like a lot of money. And are you saying that school districts, even with that extra $1 billion, that school districts can't keep up with the additional cost?
Exactly. I mean, I'm going to give you a few more numbers. I'm filled with them this morning. But 2015, again, I'll pick on that year. The pension increase was $549, but the amount of state revenue increase was $457. So $92 million is what school districts had to, local property tax owners had to kind of make up. And that's happened for all during the Governor Wolf's term, and that's happened before and under Corbett as well. It is a dynamic. It sounds like a lot of money, $100 million increase this year. But when you looked at the pension increase this year, which will probably come in at 195 or something of that sort, there's a difference. There's a gap that's being left. So when I respect the General Assembly and the governor for increasing those numbers, but it's all going towards the mandated cost.
We'll talk more about solutions according to PSBA. And take your questions as well coming up. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on the second half of today's program, John Arway, who is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, will be with us. And we're talking about raising some more money there, maybe an increase in fishing licenses. That's coming up in the second half of today's program. During this portion, kind of a follow-up of last Tuesday's discussion of property taxes. Our guest is John Callahan, Chief Advocacy Officer with the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to get back to something I just touched on, and I'm sure there are people out there who are asking this question, John, and that is, okay, almost $1 billion from the Wolf administration in the last 3 years. How much is enough?
And you know, that is the magic question in education. There's been studies out there done, and they even say, you know, you got to go up, you know, three more billion to kind of fully fund and education to the point where you have mandates, where you meet your mandates. You know, because, and what I mean by that is that there's a curriculum that's built in that we have to do in public education, and in order to get everybody proficient, they've done the studies and said this is...
Everyone proficient. You mean students.
Students, exactly.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. So, you know, you can look at it that way. And you can also look at kind of the disparate funding we have in Pennsylvania right now. And I think that's also an issue with this bill, is you have some school districts where, you know, there's $20 per kid, you know, spent. And there's some where it's $6 per kid total. And when you replace one-to-one property tax, you don't really take into that disparate nature of our system right now, that difference, you're going to lock in that kind of discrepancy. So we haven't dealt with even that issue all the way yet. I think we are in the long term kind of dealing with that and kind of normalizing that, but that's a 20-year plan. If you put this kind of bill in right now, it wouldn't recognize that and you'd still lock in that problem. So, you know, there's a lot of policy within this. That I think we just have to further kind of tweak and kind of grind through to get a solution. It's not like school boards are totally opposed to property tax changes here. We want property tax reform. We want to reduce property tax. We would love that. It's just a matter of kind of taking in the nature of, well, how do we pay for the mandates? How do we make the transition? How do we deal with the disparate nature of how we fund people differently across the state? It's all politics is local, and we've been doing it for a long time. I don't think people are afraid of it. It's just they really want, you can't go into this with blind eyes. You have to have all the facts and everything kind of planned out as much as you can in these kind of things. This is taxes, and it's not always plannable.
So PSBA doesn't support total elimination of property taxes. Mm-hmm. What do you support? What do you propose?
Well, I think we would be looking at different shifts in that, and there's all kinds of different ways of doing it. I mean, you still could do a PIT. You could still do a sales tax.
Personal
income tax. You could still broaden the base. And so what that comes is you're raising the revenue, obviously, and how you make that shift from the property tax problem you have right now. And that's one of the things that this bill really... let's get into some of the details. When that shift under this piece of legislation happens, there are lots of school districts with debt. How do we deal with that debt? Well, it still calculates in for each school district a property tax to deal with that debt over the next so many years. So even though if this piece of legislation was enacted, you still could have property tax, and probably potentially in some districts the same amount of property tax you had before, dealing with the debt you have.
How's that possible,
and
John?
And a PIT, because the debt is a problem within each school district that you have to deal with. It's a challenge you have to deal with. And you have to pay that over a certain amount of time. So if you're paying for that debt over a certain amount of time, you still have that liability on the local property tax.
Okay, now that sounds almost impossible, though, for debt to your property taxes to continue at the same rate they are, just to pay off debt.
In a few districts, that would
happen. What's a few?
I don't have all the numbers on me right now. I wish I brought that page.
Okay, we have 500 school districts in this state. I mean, we're talking 50.
We're talking a small amount, but I would say a majority of school districts will have to deal with the debt problem.
All right, so if you had a combination of ways to generate revenue, mm-hmm. property taxes, sales taxes, and as Senate Bill 76 proposes, that expand some of the items that would be subject to sales tax that aren't now, an increase in the property, personal income tax. So how would that work? I mean, you just said it would be difficult, but kind of lay it out there so people can understand this.
Yeah, and these are the kind of things, and I don't have all the solutions for this. This is a discussion that's been going on
for a century.
It seems like.
No, it has been, yeah.
So I think, you know, we would look at how you could phase that in, how you could phase down property taxes in some way by percentage and kind of go from there. But the problem is you still have to have you'd have to have a base of property tax to allow for the predictability and the stability, as well as a PIT and a sales tax on top of that. I mean, to have that base as a foundation is pretty darn stable for your school districts at this, you know, in Pennsylvania. So we'd look at that. I think, one of the other concerns that you're going to run into is when you make that shift to the state sometimes goes well beyond June when they're trying to decide their budget. So when you're talking about predictability, you're going to have to deal with that challenge a little bit too. So there's these nuances within this proposal that you really, I know we've been working on it forever. And people are nervous because we're dealing with education dollars. And I hate to put it in dollars and cents for when we're educating kids at the end of the day. And it sounds crude, but it seems to be what we're kind of in this instance meant to talk about.
A little bit of history here. 2004, during the Rendell administration, Pennsylvania made it legal for gambling, at that time slot machines. The way that that was passed was we were told there would be some property tax relief, and of course there would be money that would go to the horse racing industry. Of course, once it passed, kind of forgot all about the horse racing industry, and it was all property tax. But most people would say, I didn't see any relief. I didn't see any property tax relief. My point is that there's a lot of mistrust. Mm-hmm. So when people hear eliminating property taxes altogether, it's like, let's do that. What can go wrong? When they look, you know, again, they use that example, slots as an example, gambling as an example. They were supposed to get some property tax relief and don't feel they did.
Yeah, and I think you could take this way back to even, I guess, Casey at one point had a plan. And then we had a House plan, Sam Rohr, that didn't pass. And we've been kind of talking about that since then. We've talked about gambling expansion. We've been through this before, and it was very challenging. Each time you kind of have people's trust in government a little bit eroded each time that we do this. We've got to make sure we do it right so that people kind of can have that trust back, you know, so we can earn that trust back.
A few emails here. We have, let's see, Virginia says, I'm a widow of a 100% disabled Vietnam veteran who earned a Purple Heart for his service. His wounds were so serious, he was hospitalized for over a year. While I was working, my husband and I did not qualify for the property tax abatement. As my husband's health declined, I was forced to quit working to take care of his needs. At that point, we qualified the tax abatement offered to 100% disabled veterans. This equated to approximately $3,000 a year of expenses we were no longer obligated to pay. As a widow of a 100% disabled veteran, I qualify for the same benefit. With the proposed tax plan, the lack of property taxes would be made up with other taxes. This would add an undue hardship on veterans and their families.
I can't disagree. I mean, you really feel the need from that caller. So I don't know how much else I could say about that. There's lots of different tweaks within this law as we're looking at shifts that we have to kind of figure out. And there's one for you. You obviously hear other ones where, you know, what about I'm a lower income person and I'm going to be paying more on these things. And you know, the people that work on this tax policy try to craft that out. And I think rightly so, saying, well, you know, we're going to work on taking away different food items. I mean, so when you're talking about sales tax and other things, there's so many nuances in there that we've got to get right at the end of the day that this is no wonder we've been dealing with it for 30 or more years.
John asks, why is only real estate tax and other assets such as valuable stocks and bonds not taxed? That puts all the burden on the middle class and lets off those with greater assets. A statewide tax of this asset dedicated to education solves school funding problems. In other states, there are, I know West Virginia, for example, is one that there's a property tax on vehicles. There are other states that do that. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, other states, I was looking at Massachusetts the other day, they actually have a part of their sales tax dedicated just to school construction, for instance. And that's something that this bill doesn't fully take care of either. And the state hasn't been able to figure that out yet. Other states do it all kinds of different ways and affecting different taxpayers, you know, from the middle class to the quote unquote, you know, the upper class, and trying to kind of spread that base. That is all tax policy that will take time, and we need some due thought to make that work.
Let's take some phone calls. John is in Duncannon. John, you're on the air. Hello, John? Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, John.
Question is, your speaker talked about 63% of the taxes came from from property taxes, 36% from state funding. Our school district assesses a fairly hefty 1.3% EIT. Is that earned income tax? Is that included in the 63% that you was talking about?
Yes, that's correct. That's also included in that percent.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just property taxes coming from local.
We also got to remember that typically the property tax is the overwhelming majority of what funds your local school district. The earned income tax is a very small majority of that pot, or a small minority of that pot.
So, John, what is your earned income tax, if you don't mind me asking?
It's interesting. We pay 1.3% to the school district and 0.5% to the township. Now, and I'm questioning this because in terms of our township, the earned income tax actually brings in almost three times the amount of revenue that the property tax brings into the township.
Yeah.
Therefore,
we lost you there, John, but that's kind of another issue because this Senate Bill 76 would not touch on property taxes for local municipalities, counties, and even local townships. But what he's talking about with an earned income tax, would you support, and I think Senate Bill, whatever you call it, 76, would do the same thing, earned income tax, just increasing that, at the same time reducing property taxes.
Yeah, and increasing the earned income tax, I mean, first off, it's been done in the past. We've kind of had changes because some areas have an occupation tax, and they've been able to kind of transfer that dollar for dollar into their earned income tax. And sometimes that's why you see the above the 1% earned income tax, and you kind of see those weird, you know, 0.25 or 0.6 or whatever it is, because that's usually some other tax that was transferred over that was a little bit more of a nuisance tax. So that's kind of the history of the earned income tax. But when we're talking about school districts, that could be on the table as kind of that buffer there. And I think, you know, some of the drafters of this legislation thought about that. But I think that's all part of the package. I mean, when you're making such a large shift, you've kind of got to deal with all kinds of different policy ideas.
John, we're almost out of time for this portion of the program. Senator Argo pointed out on our program last week that when this bill came up for a vote in 2015, it ended in a tie in the Senate, and the lieutenant governor broke the tie voting against it. Things have changed now as far as the political makeup of the Senate. The proponents of this bill see a better chance of it passing. So How are you going to deal with that? What does the future look like?
I think we're going to continue to work with the legislature, you know, House and Senate, as much as we can to kind of get a bill that works at the end of the day. And if we can't, we have to recognize that and say, hey, you know, the numbers don't work, or, you know, the policy doesn't work, and educate people on that. It is, you know, within the legislature, that's just what we do. It's a meeting of the minds, trying to figure these things out in the most respectful way possible. So I think that's what school boards are going to continue to do. I think we all have the same goal in mind. We've got to have a great education system here in Pennsylvania for the future of our citizens. So with that in mind, I think cool heads can come together and make something work.
Even after 40 years?
I hope to goodness.
Will you be back this time next year talking about the same issue?
It could happen.
Yeah, I have a feeling we could be. Anyway, John Callahan with the Pennsylvania School Board Association. Thank you, John, for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The cost of a fishing license in Pennsylvania is $21. It hasn't changed since 2005. The Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, which stocks fish, cares for public waters, and maintains hatcheries, dams, and other infrastructure, is funded by money from fishing licenses and the federal government. Commission Executive Director John R. Way proposed a $6 increase for the cost of a fishing license for 1 year, and then a price hike of 3% every year for 4 years. R. Way said without the license increase, hatcheries would have to close and fewer trout stocked in streams. He also designated streams where fewer trout would be stocked, and they have to be in the districts of legislators who oppose the license increase. Now those lawmakers want to set a term limit on the executive director of the Fish and Boat Commission to 8 years. John R. Way is completing his eighth year. John R. Way, executive director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, is our guest. Director R. Way, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for inviting me back.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. All right. Before we get into the current controversy, I guess we can call it, let's talk about some background here. As I just mentioned, there has not been an increase in the fishing license fee since 2005. Why do you think that license should go up by $6 now? And as I mentioned, $3 for 4 years, or I should say 3% for 4 years after that.
Well, Scott, you set the stage pretty well for me by having John Callahan on and talking about why property taxes have to go up to fund education. The same reasons apply to fishing licenses. Our expenses have increased over time because of a variety of things. John explained about pensions and health care. Well, that applies to my staff, too, as well as teachers. But also, we've seen a decline in license sales. We peaked at 1.2 million in 1990, and we've seen a steady decline since then because less people fish in society than used to. Even though Pennsylvania's population is stable or slightly increasing, we're not seeing that trend with fishing license sales. It's much worse on the hunting side, but on the fishing side, there's a gradual slow decline in the number of people that are fishing. So we're working to try to get people to fish again, but the problem is when I was young, the Fish and Boat Commission didn't have to teach people how to fish to get their interest in fishing. We all learned from our parents, grandparents, friends, and family, and they were the mentors for us. We're losing those mentors, so we've got to take a new look at a way to market our program so that we can get more people fishing.
You touched on reasons that costs are going up, but if fewer people are fishing, why do you need more money? I mean, that would seem to, if you look at supply and demand, that if there are fewer people fishing, that cost should be cut.
You just brought the grill out of the closet, Scott. And that's exactly true. I'm glad you understand it. But the problem is we still stock 3.2 million trout, whether it was for the 1.2 million people or for the 860,000 people that buy fishing licenses. So there's a lot of happy people because there's more trout out there per license buyer than there ever has been in a long time. But the problem is those trout cost the same or more to produce today with less money. So as a result of that, we've come to a point where we've been able to pay the extra expenses by not filling positions. We've gone from 432 staff down to 366. 70% of our budget is salaries for employees, salaries and benefits. So we've been able to save some money by cutting staff to pay the bills up until now. But I called it the fiscal slope. We were on a fiscal slope when I first started telling the legislator about this problem 8 years ago when I became director. We've been able to, you know, change the slope of the fiscal slope, but now we're at the fiscal cliff. We can't cut any more staff without having to cut programs in order to pay these escalating costs.
Again, I go back to fewer trout being stocked. If there are fewer anglers out there, that fewer people fishing. So, why is this an issue if the Fish and Boat Commission said we are not going to be able to afford to continue to stock at the level we are now?
Well, we put a plan together. We have a plan for what the agency would do if we would get a license increase and what we would do if we don't get a license increase. If we don't get a license increase, we've got to cut some of our more expensive programs. Our hatchery program is 25% of our agency budget. They're only down 10% in staff right now, so that's one of the vulnerable programs only because it's expensive. We hired the Penn State Smill Business College to do a business plan for the agency, since we live off of customer sales, much like most for-profit businesses. And they came back and said that hatcheries are one of the programs that you recognize should be cut first because the demand for those fish has decreased and the supply of those fish has stayed the same.
Okay, I understand that, and I think most people do. But what happened is that you drew up a map of where hatcheries were, you know, some hatcheries that would be closed, and streams and waterways that wouldn't be stocked with as many trout. They just happened to be in the districts where the legislators who oppose the fishing license increase are located. Why'd you do that?
Well, we made that decision based on a number of variables: economic, social, biological, and political. The hatcheries themselves were selected based on economic variables. Where can we save the most money? So we looked at our least efficient hatcheries. That was the Oswego hatchery. It cost us more to raise a fish and stock a fish from that hatchery than any of our other hatcheries. So it made sense. If we were going to look at closing a hatchery down, that would be one. Union City is a cool warm water hatchery, and our Van Dyke Shad Research Center is another hatchery to get us to a target of $2 million in cuts, which the Board of Commissioners set for me to do, and that would get us to that target $2 million to save enough money to pay these extra bills. So how did we do it? Well, I looked at, again, social factors, biological factors, and political factors. And we knew how many, if we closed Oswego, we were going to not stock 220,000 fish. So we looked at what streams we would stop stocking, and the obvious ones were the ones that were close to Oswego, because that would save us the most money, so we didn't have to transport fish from Center County up to Potter County. And then I felt that why should we cut streams in districts that supported us? You know, they were representing the anglers and boaters out there, the angler and boater interests. And the angler and boaters aren't driving this discussion. They understand the need for a license increase. I just came out of six sportsman's forums around the state. We started in Harrisburg, went to Pittsburgh, went to Erie, went to the Poconos, were at the Philly Boat Show, and ended up on Saturday at Lycoming County, at Lycoming College. And everybody almost unanimously says, we understand the prices have gone up over time. We're going to have to pay a little extra more if you're going to meet our expectations of 3.2 million fish. So the cuts were really designed to take pressure off the districts that supported us, but it shifted it to those cuts to districts, to legislators that didn't support us.
You just said it, John, and I admire your honesty by admitting that there were political considerations in there. But you had to know that that would be a shot over the bow of those legislators who oppose the license increase. And they have power to do a lot of things, including right now, try to limit your term. In other words, fire you.
And I understand that, Scott, but I took the risk, knowing that there were going to be repercussions, but I had to get attention to this problem, because I've been arguing that we were on this slope for 8 years, and I haven't gotten any traction on the slope. So we got to the fiscal cliff. I don't want to shut hatcheries down. Believe me, I want to continue to meet the expectations of anglers and boaters. But at the same time, the reality is that we've got to either cut expenses or raise revenues. And that's what the conclusion of the Penn State study was. So I took that step. That map was up for less than 28 hours or 24 hours on our website. It was pulled down. That option's off the table because of the political firestorm it created. But to this day, not one legislator has come up with an alternative solution for us to pay the bills. John Arway can go tomorrow, but that financial dilemma is still going to be with the commission, no matter if I'm there or not.
Let's take a phone call from Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim.
Mr. Arway was pretty frank about the situation, and I'm going to be even more frank. The problem we have goes beyond the Fish and Boat Commission. It also covers the Game Commission, as I think Director Arway knows. We have a Game Commission and we have a Fish and Boat Commission, which were set up to directly rule and administer, in one case, our fishing and protecting fish, and in the other case, hunting and protecting species and that sort of thing. And what's happened is we have a dysfunctional legislature that should be focused on stuff like, property tax reform, which we just talked about, and pension reform. Instead, they're micromanaging, and they're basically holding the fish and game and fish and boat and game hostage and saying, well, if you don't play ball with us, we're not going to allow you to raise rates. What should happen is we should pass comprehensive legislation that allows the Fish and Boat Commission and the Game Commission to regulate fees. And, you know, if they do a bad job and if they raise them too high, then they can get rid of the commissioners and elect some new ones. But we can't have the situation we have now where the legislature is micromanaging the commissions that have been set up to regulate this area. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. John?
Jim, thanks for the call and the possible solution, because actually what you proposed was an outcome of a discussion I had with Senator John Eichelberger and Senator Wozniak, two senators in Bedford County, at a legislative luncheon a couple of years ago. And they said, you know, instead of us raising fees, why don't we just give you the authority to raise your own fees? You know your business better than we do. And they recognized that. So the Senate passed legislation twice over the last two sessions. This year's bill is Senate Bill 30. It went through the Senate almost unanimously, and it sat in the House, got through the committee, the House Game and Fisheries Committee 2 years ago, failed to pass or even be considered on the House floor. Today, that Senate Bill 30, which gives the Fish and Boat Commission the authority to set our own fees, because as those two senators recognized, we know our business better than they do, and they put boundaries on that legislation. We couldn't set fees so high that we were going to have an impact on our business, and they could overrule us if they felt that we were abusing our authority, that they would delegate to us with Senate Bill 30. However, that bill never got up for discussion in the House Game and Fisheries Committee this year, and hasn't moved any closer to the House for final decision.
I'm curious. Do you know where Senator Eichelberger and Wozniak, by the way, Republican and Democrat, where they stand on this proposal that would limit the executive director to 8 years?
Senator Wozniak isn't in the Senate. He retired last year. And
that's right.
Yeah, you would have to ask Senator Eichelberger.
Yeah. Let's take another phone call from Chris in Bethlehem. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I don't know. Speaking for myself and the general, I'm part of the wild trout crowd. John probably knows what I'm talking about. It's a shame that the legislator is holding the Fish Commission hostage over this. There needs to be a comprehensive change in the culture and the way we view trout and the way we view opening day. And it's just insane. Pennsylvania has 4,000 miles of wild trout streams. There are many streams where trout can reproduce naturally, can support themselves. They don't, and the Fish Commission is basically forced to stock hatchery raised fish over these wild fish, which is a detriment to the wild fish in those streams. And the culture is that people have this idea that they should be able to walk up to a stream, throw the line in, fill their string with fish, and go home. And that's not the way it is. That's just not the way it is anymore. There just needs to be some education with the general public of the way things are now. Times have changed, And the put and take culture is not sustainable. It's obviously not sustainable. And it's not John Arway's fault. It's not the Fish Commission's fault. It's the general public. And by the general public, I'm also talking about the legislators that are holding the Fish Commission hostage. It's sad. And we're behind you, John. And we want you to do the right thing. And it's just a shame.
Thank you very much for your call. His point about whether streams in Pennsylvania, waterways in Pennsylvania could support wild trout, could they?
That's interesting. We're right in the middle of studying that very question, Scott, and we're finding some very interesting things out. When I started my tenure as director 8 years ago, we had a commissioner, Bill Warbeck, who was an advocate of trying to get our streams better assessed. Where do our trout streams exist? A lot of the streams that we had, we never really surveyed before because they were in places that weren't at risk. Those trout weren't at risk. Then we saw the development of Marcellus and deep gas in our state, which drilled wells on mountaintops that had never been disturbed before. And the streams in the valley bottoms were at risk of erosion and sedimentation and discharges of produced fluids from those sites. So we started enlisting. I asked my staff, how long would it take for us to survey those streams? And they said, about 247 years. And I said, not a good answer. Mm-hmm. So we went out and enlisted the support and help of colleges and universities. The same professors that taught my staff fisheries biology are helping us now with their students surveying these streams. And we found some interesting things so far. One is Pennsylvania has 86,000 miles of flowing streams and rivers, second most only in Alaska in the United States. 30% of the waters that we've surveyed so far are part of a wild trout watershed. We've got a tremendous fishery for wild trout in our state that a lot of people don't recognize. A lot of people just think trout fishing comes out of the Great White Truck. The reality of it is we got so many miles of streams around. That's not to say that we don't have to support some recreational fishing. A lot of people can't travel to northern Potter County to fish for wild trout. They'd like to fish for trout in urban areas. So we have to look at the model that we've used for wild trout and stock trout much differently today than we used to look at it, because we're learning more and more about where our wild trout live, where our trout fishermen fish, and that's part of what this national initiative, R3, is called, Recruitment, Retention, Reactivation.
When we talked about the issue of the politics involved in this, this is not the first time that you have been on the other side of the legislature. And I think back to you had asked that the Susquehanna River be designated as, I don't know, is endangered the correct terminology?
Impaired.
Impaired, there we go. And the legislature said no, or the ruling came down that no, we're not going to do that. First of all, do you still believe that the Susquehanna is impaired? And is there a history here between you and the legislature, DEP, other branches of government?
Actually, that wasn't the legislature, Scott.
I knew I was wrong when I said that.
That was really a former administration and a couple of secretaries of DEP that disagreed with my conclusion. And we debated that quite a bit. We debated it here on your show. I sat here with Mike Ranzer at one time, and we talked about the issues. So that was really not a political battle. That was more a inside government disagreement. Because of the delay in that decision, and that decision still hasn't been made, by the way, Scott, DEP still doesn't know whether they're going to declare the river impaired or not. But we were lucky. Mother Nature intervened. We had a couple high flows in the springtime, cool water, got a couple successful spawns out of the river, and the river kind of healed itself for a while. However, we still have infected fish, bacterially infected fish in the river that concern me, which is why we still have our catch and release regulations in place on the river that I think has helped benefit that fishery. But today, I would tell all your listeners, if you want a trophy bass fishery, if you want to fish for trophy bass, the Susquehanna here between Sunbury and Maryland is probably one of the best smallmouth bass fisheries right now on the East Coast. But we can't let down our guard. What happened, we had that massive fish kill in 2005, that could repeat itself any year in the future.
John Arway is currently the executive director of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We'll see what happens with this.
Well, thanks, Scott. I hope to see you again.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, criminals lose the right to carry guns sometimes, but still can get a hunting license. The York Daily Record has authored a series on this issue. We'll talk to the reporters who filed that report tomorrow. Also, Martin Luther King, Dauphin County, commemorating Dr. Martin Luther King. That comes up on tomorrow's show.